most. Aunt Baba had dressed her in pretty pink silk trousers with a matching jacket and pink cloth shoes. Her hair was neatly combed into two little beribboned braids that stood up on each side, bobbing as she walked. She looked like a big doll with her large round eyes and chubby pink cheeks, rushing around the sitting room, examining the dishes of candy, melon seeds, peanuts, ginger slices, and salted plums laid out on the coffee table, and then running back to Aunt Baba. All of us beckoned to her and vied for her attention as she teased us by half advancing and then quickly retreating to Aunt Baba's side. Repeatedly, Niang signaled her baby to come to her. But to little sister, her mother was a stranger, and she ignored her. Niang was dressed in a dark brown Parisian silk dress, with dangling pearl earrings and a string of large pearls around her neck. 15 feet away, I could still smell the cloying aroma of her perfume. Trying to help, Aunt Baba unwrapped a piece of candy and waved it. Little sister ran eagerly toward our aunt. Aunt Baba handed the candy to Niang, who waved it back and forth, attempting to entice her daughter to go to her. Rejecting the bribe and becoming annoyed, little sister ran to the candy dish instead and tipped all the candies onto the carpet. Growing visibly impatient, Niang approached little sister while we scrambled to pick up the candies. "Bad girl!" 4-year-old fourth brother screamed at his baby sister. "You shouldn't have done that," big sister added in a stern voice, trying to curry favor with Niang. The rest of us remained silent. "Don't want you," little sister said directly to Niang in a distinct voice. "Don't like you. Go away." Surprised and hurt, Niang bent down to pick up her baby, who was wriggling and resisting with all her might. An unnatural hush fell upon the room. All eyes were on them as mother and daughter struggled. Little sister was now howling at the top of her voice while tears rolled down her little cheeks. "Don't want you," she repeated loudly. "Aunt Baba, Aunt Baba, tell her to go away. Go away." No one said a word as Niang carried her, weeping and kicking child, and placed her firmly on the couch next to her. Little sister was pushing blindly against her mother's neck and face, now red and contorted with frustration. "Keep still," Niang screamed futilely again and again in a piercing voice. In the melee, the string holding her pearls broke, and the precious gems tumbled one by one, rolling across the carpet onto the wooden floor. This proved simply too much for Niang. Thoroughly exasperated, she gave her baby's face a stinging slap. Little sister only cried more loudly. Deliberately and viciously, Niang now set about beating her daughter in earnest. Her blows landed indiscriminately on little sister's ears, cheeks, neck, and head. Everyone cowered as the punishment went on and on. The grown-ups avoided looking at each other, while we children shrank into our seats. I couldn't understand why Father, Yaya, and Aunt Baba were making no attempt to stop the assault. Why wasn't anyone objecting? I wanted to run away, but dared not move. I knew I should remain silent, but words choked me, and I felt compelled to spit them out. Finally, I could bear it no longer. Quaking with terror, I blurted out, "Don't beat her anymore. She's only a baby." My protest seemed to halt Niang in the midst of her frenzy. Little sister's screams also simmered down to a whimper. Niang glared at me. Her large, prominent eyes appeared to be popping out of their orbits with fury. "How dare you?" she said through her teeth. For a few seconds, I was fearful she was going to pounce on me instead. Across the room, Aunt Baba gave me a warning look and a slight shake of her head, telling me to say no more. In those few moments, we had understood everything. Not only about Niang, but also about all the grown-ups. Now that Nai Nai was dead, there was no doubt who was in charge. Fuming with rage, Niang slowly extended her right arm and pointed her index finger at me. I felt panic-stricken and saw only my stepmother's long, red, perfectly manicured fingernail aimed straight at me. Then I heard her words, loaded with malice, which made my heart jump and the hair stand up on the back of my neck. "Get out," she snarled in a cold, distinctive voice. "I shall never forgive you. Never. 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 You'd better watch out from now on. You will pay for your arrogance." Chapter 8. Tram Fare. Though father sent us to expensive missionary schools, he and Niang instituted an austerity program to teach us the value of money. To begin with, we were given no pocket money whatsoever, not even the tram fare. We had nothing to wear except our school uniforms. Big Sister and I were ordered to keep our haircuts short, straight, and old-fashioned. For my three brothers, it was much worse. Their heads were shaved bald in the style of Buddhist monks, and they were teased mercilessly by their peers. My school was a mile and a half from home, immediately adjacent to Big Sister's school. The number 8 tram ran directly from door to door. St. John's Academy was 3 miles away and could be reached by the same number 8 tram traveling in the opposite direction. When Ye Ye first arrived in Shanghai, we begged him for money and he gave us our tram fare to go to school. 2 months later, Ye Ye had spent all his money, and he brought up the subject one evening. Dinner was almost over and everyone was eating fruit when Aunt Baba mentioned that she had decided to go back to work as a bank teller at Grand Aunt's bank. This was probably her way of reminding father that she and Ye Ye had run out of money for their daily needs. We were holding our breath on their behalf. Father and Niang looked annoyed. "You don't need to work like a commoner," father said. "You have everything you need here. Besides, Ye Ye enjoys your companionship at home. If either of you needs money, why don't you come to us and ask? I've told you both before that if I'm busy or in the office, all you have to do is speak to Jean, Niang, here, and she'll give it to you." "How is this possible?" I asked myself. "Where is Ye Ye's own money? Is he no longer head of our family? Why is he suddenly and mysteriously dependent on father and Niang for pocket money?" It made me cringe to think of my gentle and dignified grandfather begging for pocket money from my haughty stepmother. "You are both so generous and employ so many servants that I find little I can do to help," Aunt Baba replied politely. "The children are away all day at school. Going out to work every day will get me out of the house and give me something to do." Father now appealed to Ye Ye. "What do you think? Won't you miss her?" "Let her work if that's what she enjoys," Ye Ye answered. "She likes to spend her salary on playing mahjong and buying treats for the children. By the way, I meant to mention this to you before. the children should be given a regular weekly allowance.
What for? Father asked, turning to us.
Hasn't everything been provided for you?
Well, for one thing, replied Big Sister, speaking on behalf of all of us, we need the tram fare daily to go to school.
Tram fare? Niang interjected sharply. Who told you you could ride the tram? Why can't you walk? Exercise is good for you.
It's too far to walk to St. John's. By the time we get there, it'll be time to turn around and go home again, Big Brother said.
Nonsense, Father exclaimed. Walking is good for growing children like you.
I loathe walking, Big Brother grumbled, especially first thing in the morning.
How dare you contradict your father, Niang threatened. If he orders you to walk to school, then it's your duty to obey him. Do you hear?
We were cowed into silence and looked toward Yuya, expecting him to come to our defense. But he kept his eyes on his plate and went on peeling his apple.
Big Sister suddenly took the plunge. Yuya has always given us pocket money. We're used to going to school by tram. Nobody in my class walks to school. Most of my classmates are driven there in private cars.
Niang became enraged.
Your father works so hard to support everyone under this roof, she exclaimed in a loud, angry voice, shooting a quick glance at Yuya and Aunt Baba.
How sneaky you all are to get money from Yuya without your father's knowledge.
We send you to expensive schools so you'll grow up correctly. We certainly don't want you to be coddled into becoming idle layabouts.
From now on, all of you are forbidden to go behind our backs to trouble Yuya or Aunt Baba for money. Do you hear?
Though her remarks were addressed to us, they were obviously meant for Yuya and Aunt Baba as well. She paused briefly and then continued.
We're not saying you're never to ride the tram again. We merely want you to acknowledge your past errors. Admit you've been wrong. Promise you'll change for the better. Come to us and apologize. Tell us from now on you will behave differently. We'll give you the tram fare only if you're truly contrite.
The room was completely still. The only sound I heard was that of Yuya chomping on his apple. Surely he was going to say something to put Niang in her place.
The maids hustled around with hot, moist towels for us to wipe our fingers and mouths. Then Niang spoke again in a sugary tone, looking directly at Yuya with a smile.
These tangerines are so juicy and sweet. Here, do have one. Let me peel it for you.
At first, we were all mad. The whole tram fare issue was obviously somehow tied up with the establishment of a new hierarchy within our family. Now that Nainai was dead, was Niang going to take over? We told each other we would always be loyal to Yuya.
If necessary, we intended to walk to school forever, or at least until graduation, to show our allegiance to him. 10 days later, I spotted Big Sister getting off the tram at the stop closest to our lane. Though she ignored me, and I dared not say anything to her, she had obviously given in. My three brothers held out week after week. St. John's was so far from home. The weather turned cold and nasty. They were getting up in the dark and returning home exhausted. One after another, they gradually knuckled under.
though Yuya and Aunt Baba both kept urging me to go downstairs and beg for my tram fare, I just couldn't do it. Why? I hardly knew myself. Something to do with loyalty, fair play, and a sense of obligation. I did not discuss this with anyone, not even Aunt Baba. I simply couldn't force myself to go to Niang and admit that I, and therefore Yuya, had erred in the past. Besides, just didn't seem right to betray him, especially when I had begged for the money from him in the first place. When the rain pelted down in sheets and gales howled through the streets, I would grit my teeth as I set about the seemingly endless journey along Avenue Joffre. Arriving drenched at the school gates, I tried not to look at my schoolmates stepping daintily out of rickshaws, pedicabs, and chauffeur-driven cars. I knew some of them laughed at me behind my back and whispered to each other that I took my own number 11 private tram to school daily, meaning that my legs carried me. On Sunday afternoons, Niang frequently called out for my siblings to come downstairs to her bedroom, which third brother had nicknamed the Holy of Holies, and pick up their tram fares. Hearing this, I'd feel a stab of anguish because I was the only one always excluded. Big sister sometimes came back upstairs to show off by laying her coins in a row on my bed and counting them aloud, one by one, in front of me. Chapter 9, Chinese New Year. We had been looking forward to Chinese New Year for weeks. It was a holiday not only for all the school children in China, but for all the grown-ups as well. Even father was taking off 3 whole days from work to celebrate. For the first time since our departure from Tianjin, a tailor had come to our house to measure everyone for new outfits. In China, new clothes were worn on New Year's Day to signal a new beginning. On New Year's Eve, Father and Niang summoned us down to the Holy of Holies and gave us our new clothes. My 3 brothers were terribly disappointed to find 3 identical, loose-fitting, long Chinese gowns made of dark blue wool, with traditional Mandarin collars and cloth buttons. Big sister was handed a padded silk Chinese qi pao. I got a basic brown smock made of material left over from one of Big sister's garments. 4th brother, however, received a stylish Western outfit with a Peter Pan collar and matching tie and belt, while little sister acquired a fashionable knitted pink dress bedecked with ribbons and bows. We 5 stepchildren trooped back upstairs in disgust. My brothers threw their robes on their beds contemptuously. They'd been looking forward to Western-style suits, shirts, and ties. That was what their trend-setting schoolmates were wearing at St. John's. "Trash," Big Brother declared, tossing his new garment in the air and kicking it. "Who wants junk like this? You'd think we're still living in the Qing Dynasty. As if it's not bad enough to be called the 3 Buddhist monks. If they see us dressed in these outdated, antique clothes, we might as well forget about going to school altogether." "The other day," third brother complained bitterly, "my desk partner asked me when I was going to start growing a pigtail and shaving my brow. Maybe you're planning to be the new Emperor Puyi and live in the Forbidden Palace," he told me. "What gets me," Big Sister said, "is the blatant inequality between her children and us. I wouldn't mind if all 7 of us were treated the same way. If they really believed in traditional clothes, then all 7 children should be wearing them, not just the 5 of us. "Aside from the clothes," second brother interrupted, "what about our shaved heads? I don't see 4th brother sporting a Buddhist monk special. Why, the little princeling has his hair cut at the most fashionable children's hairstylist on Nanjing Lu. When he stands next to us, it's like we've stepped out of two different centuries. Here, Father wants to teach us the value of money, Big Brother added. Yet her children can order whatever they desire from the kitchen at any hour of the day or night. We're supposed to eat only 3 meals a day with congee and preserved vegetables for breakfast every morning. But I see Cook preparing bacon, eggs and toast, fresh berries and melon for their breakfast. Last Sunday, I went into the kitchen and told Cook I wanted a slice of bacon. The idiot won't even give me a straight answer. I have my orders, he told me. Bacon is reserved for the first floor. One day, I'm going to sock him in the mouth. It's really getting intolerable, Big Sister complained, lowering her voice and motioning me to close the door. I obeyed with alacrity, happy to be included. We should be careful, though. Yang has her spies. That new tutor nanny she's employed for her 2 children, that Miss Jen, she gives me the creeps. She is so slimy and obsequious, smiling and bowing all the time. Yesterday, she cornered me and invited me to have afternoon tea with 4th brother and little sister in their nursery. I never saw such a spread. Finger sandwiches, toasted buns, chestnut cream cake, sausage rolls. Here we are restricted to breakfast, lunch, and dinner and starving between meals, while our half-siblings are throwing their leftovers from their balcony to Jackie in the garden. It's so unfair. Anyway, Miss Jen kept quizzing me about Yuya, Aunt Baba, all of you, and what we think of Niang. Of course, I didn't reveal anything. I'm sure whatever I'd have said would have been reported straight back to our stepmother. I simply detest that sneaky stool pigeon, Miss Jen, Big Brother confessed. Day before yesterday, Father calls the 3 of us down to the Holy of Holies. Big lecture. Miss Jen says that one of you was playing with the tap of the filtered water tank on the stairway. How many times have I told you not to drink out of that tank? It's permanently out of bounds to you, do you hear? If you want drinking water, you get it from the hot water thermos flask in the kitchen. Otherwise, you boys have a habit of leaving the tap turned on when there is temporarily no water. Later on, when the tap water percolates through the filter, there is a big pool of water on the stairs. Your mother has had enough of it. So we deny that we even touch the tap. Does he believe us? Of course not. I told Father that I personally observed Miss Jen fiddling around with the tap early that morning. Probably no one ever warned her about how finicky the water tank is. What's the end result? Father chooses to believe her, and we each got 2 lashes from the dog whip. The liar! I hate her. This just can't go on, Big Sister declared. Let's get organized. If we unite together and protest in one voice, they won't ignore us. What about a hunger strike? That's sure to get their attention. Are you ready to join us, 5th younger sister, Wu Mei? I was thrilled that Big Sister was addressing me personally. Of course I am, I exclaimed ardently. But I don't think a hunger strike will work. They'll probably be very happy that we're not eating. 5 less mouths to feed, that's all. For a hunger strike to succeed, they've got to care whether we live or die. I'm for a revolution, 2nd brother exclaimed. Out and out war. We go to the kitchen, open the refrigerator, eat what we want, and face the consequences. What can they do? The food's already in our stomachs being digested. Won't be so easy to get it back out. You're always so impulsive and volatile, Big Brother exclaimed critically. Just like that rash general Zhang Fei in the Three Countries War. We've got to be more subtle and patient. Diplomacy and subterfuge are always superior to confrontation. Let's ask for a private conference with Father and point out the inequities in a calm, logical fashion. It won't work, Third Brother counseled. Father will never come to the table without Niang. What about an anonymous letter written in Chinese sent to Father through the mail? Niang doesn't read any Chinese. Big Sister could write it with brush and ink. Her handwriting is excellent and can pass for that of an adult. Brilliant idea! Exclaimed Big Sister. Let's draft the letter now. We hunched over the table, muttering suggestions, becoming more and more excited at our escapade. Third Brother decided he might as well go to the bathroom and relieve himself while the letter was being written. He yanked open the door, stepped outside, and, to his horror, almost collided with Niang, who was standing immediately behind the portal with her ear glued against it. Ashen-faced and petrified, he stared dumbly at our stepmother without fully closing the door while she looked down at him disdainfully. There was a deathly silence as they regarded each other. Third Brother started to tremble with terror. Slowly, Niang raised her right index finger against her lips, warning him not to make a sound. She then waved him on with her open left hand. In the bathroom, as he told us a few moments later, Third Brother locked the door carefully behind him. Recalling Niang's intimidating stare, sphinx-like immobility and expression of distinctive menace, he was seized by a surge of nausea. How long had she been listening? What had she heard? Was everyone still plotting? Would they send him away from home? Where could he go? He vomited again and again, rinsing his mouth out over and over at the tap, dreading the moment of truth. If only he could postpone his return indefinitely and stay here forever. Alone. Uninvolved. Away from everyone. Behind a locked door. A thought suddenly hit him like a blow. What if Niang was still waiting for him to go back? Could his absence be construed as a deliberate warning to the others that something was afoot? How long had he been away? He felt his mouth go dry as he quickly flushed the toilet and stumbled out. His legs seemed to keep buckling under in an extraordinary way. He hurried back and noticed at once that no one was standing outside his bedroom door. A wave of relief washed over him. True, the door was still slightly ajar, the way he'd left it, but Niang was no longer there. He could clearly hear the murmur of Big Sister's voice, tinged with purpose and excitement, drifting down the corridor. Niang must have caught every word. He returned and collapsed in his seat, absolutely drained. "It's over! We're doomed!" he cried tremulously, quaking with fear. In a leaden voice, he related his encounter with Niang outside the bedroom door. A profound and uneasy silence came over us. We stared at each other, dumbfounded. Slowly but methodically, we set about destroying all the draft copies of the incriminating anonymous letter of appeal to Father. Big Sister tore the paper into shreds while muttering, "Deny everything," over and over. Big Brother lit a match and reduced the whole lot to ashes, which we scattered outside the window. When the dinner bell rang, we trooped downstairs stoically to face the music, telling each other we were in this together and would resist with a united front. We were prepared for confrontation, but dinner came and went without incident. In fact, Niang seemed more cordial than usual, reminding us that the next day was Chinese New Year. We should dress in our new clothes. As a special treat, we would be served a salted duck egg for breakfast. Then Father would take us for a drive in his motor car along the Bund, the grand embankment along the river, ending with a visit to Grand Aunt's bank at 480 Nanjing Lu, where we had all been invited to lunch. When we returned upstairs after dinner and still nothing had been mentioned, we could hardly believe our good luck. We began to question Third Brother's sanity. Had he imagined that Niang had overheard us? But he stuck to his story. "Perhaps," he suggested darkly, "we're being kept deliberately in a state of uncertainty because that's what Niang most enjoys, the cat-and-mouse game." Once again, we began to feel sick with apprehension, but there was nothing we could do but wait. What Niang decided to do was divide our loyalty by recruiting our leader, Big Sister, over to their side. The next day, as we rose from the table after a festive New Year's dinner, Niang smiled at Big Sister and invited her to move downstairs into a spare bedroom on the second floor. Their floor. Her offer aroused a number of disturbing emotions among us. After Big Sister, Da Jie, moved down to the second floor, she started assuming airs and distancing herself from those of us left on the floor above. She yearned to gain Niang's favor and gradually came to realize the importance of being on good terms with Miss Jin. The latter shared a room with Niang's two children and catered to their every wish, particularly those of Fourth Brother, Niang's favorite darling. As the days went by, Big Sister's, Da Jie's, attitude toward Miss Jin underwent a profound change. The two became friends, bound by a mutual aptitude and appetite for intrigue. Big Sister, Da Jie, would scurry around to Niang at every opportunity to list her grievances against her former allies, fawning on those in favor and gossiping about those fallen from grace. She vaunted her newfound power to instill fear, and Niang rewarded her with special favors, gifts, pocket money, outings with friends. There were no more private gatherings among the five of us, let alone anonymous letters to Father. Full of envy and discontent, we four met to discuss the situation. "Why is she being so favored?" Big Brother asked. "This has been especially noticeable since Niang eavesdropped on us New Year's Eve. Niang must have learned then that Big Sister is our so-called leader. She is the only one capable of disguising her handwriting to write a credible anonymous letter to Father in Chinese. What's going on between her and Niang? I don't trust either of them. They are two of a kind and will hatch up something horrible when they team up like this." "She has allegiance to Niang written all over her face," Second Brother added. "She makes me sick." "She probably makes up outrageous lies about us and adds oil and soy sauce to everything Niang likes to hear," agreed Third Brother. Her method of getting ahead is to inform on everyone up here. The maids were moving furniture into her room yesterday. The door was open, so I went in, confided Big Brother. Do you know she now has her own writing desk and chest of drawers? Here, the three of us have to share a room, but she not only has a room to herself, but a lacy white bedspread and curtains to match. While I was looking around, she sneaked behind me and tapped me on the shoulder. In future, knock and ask permission before coming in here, she commanded. I almost threw up when I heard her aggressive and overbearing voice. You'd think she'd turned into Niang herself. She has obviously defected, Third Brother related. The way she struts around. Yesterday, I was coming up the stairs when I saw Big Sister at the doorway of Fourth Brother's bedroom, begging him for a teeny-weeny piece of chocolate cake to tide her over until dinner. It made me ill to watch her sucking up to the wily little squirt, groveling and demeaning herself like that. What sort of leader is she anyway? Whose side is she on? I'd rather starve to death than lick the boots of Fourth Brother. Big Brother turned to me. I saw Big Sister with her arm around you yesterday asking you questions. Beware of her. She is an expert at feigning affection. Don't trust her or tell her anything. Otherwise, you'll get hurt. Just remember, she's not like other people's big sisters. She doesn't love anyone, certainly not you. If she can, she will do you in. There was no doubt about it. In no time at all, Big Sister had completely gone over to the other side. I grew even closer to my aunt. Our room became my refuge. Coming home from school every afternoon, I was ever so glad to cross its threshold, close the door, and spread out my books. Doing homework was the only way to cushion myself from the harrowing uncertainties all around. I knew Niang loathed me and despised my aunt. It saddened me that Aunt Baba seemed to be under a life sentence of subordination. Though I was little, I understood the awkwardness of her position. How Niang's wishes always took precedence. How she had to demonstrate caution, submission, and humility at every turn. I found it impossible to speak of this to anyone. It was simply too painful. Instead, I tried to make it up to my aunt by studying hard and getting perfect report cards. Besides, that seemed to be the only way to please my father or get any attention from him whatsoever. I was 7 years old and in the second grade. The girls in my class nicknamed me Genius, partly because of my perfect scholastic record, but also because of my compositions and short stories. I started writing by accident. Mrs. Lin, my Chinese literature teacher, whose daughter Lin Tao Tao was my classmate, once gave our class a homework assignment to write a composition titled My Best Friend. Most girls wrote about their mothers. I didn't know mine, so I wrote of my aunt. My aunt and I share a room. She is my best friend and cares about me in every way. Not only about my hair, my clothes, and how I look, but also about my studies, my thoughts, and what I am. Though I am really nothing, she makes me believe I am special. When I get a good report card, she locks it in her safe deposit box and wears the key around her neck even when she sleeps, as if my grades were her most cherished treasures. My mama and my aunt used to be best friends. Sometimes I dream of my mama on my walks to and from school. I think mama lives high up on a mountain in a magic castle. One day, if I am really good and study very hard, she will ride down on a cloud to rescue me and take me to live with her. Nothing in Shanghai can compare with her place. It's a fairyland full of fragrant flowers, towering pines, lovely rocks, soaring bamboos, and chirping birds. Every child can enter without a ticket, and girls are treated the same as boys. No one is sneered at or scolded without a reason. It's called paradise. Mrs. Lin gave me a high mark and pinned my composition on the bulletin board. From then on, I wrote whenever I had a spare moment. It thrilled me to bring my literary efforts to school and to see my classmates pass them illicitly from desk to desk. Groups of girls would gather around me during recess to discuss my stories or to hear me read aloud the latest escapades of my imaginary heroines. To me, writing was pure pleasure. It thrilled me to be able to escape the horrors of my daily life in such a simple way. When I wrote, I forgot that I was an unwanted daughter who had caused her mother's death. Instead, I could be anybody I wished to be. In my narratives, I poured out everything that I dared not say out loud. I was friends with the beautiful princesses and dashing knights who lived in my imagination. I was no longer the lonely little girl bullied by her siblings. Instead, I was the female warrior, Mulan, who would rescue her aunt and Yuya from harm. In time, my stories became real to my schoolmates also. Once, I used the surname Lin to portray a villain. Lin Tao Tao read the tale, angrily erased Lin, and scribbled Yen, my family name, in its place. A quarrel ensued between us, each one enraged because the other had used her name in such a fashion. When I tried to erase my name and reinsert hers, Lin Tao Tao suddenly burst into tears. "It's only make-believe," I protested, feeling ashamed for having made her cry. "No, it isn't. You know it isn't. Look, you're rubbing so hard, you've made a hole in the paper." We both stared at the hole. And suddenly, it struck me that we were arguing over nothing. I pointed to the hole and started to giggle. "We're quarreling over a hole," I told her. "A hole is nothing. We're fighting about nothing." Soon she was laughing too. "How about calling your villain Wu Ming, no name?" she suggested. "That way, nothing becomes no name, and nobody gets mad at anybody." "Brilliant! Let's shake hands on that." So the title of my story became The Villain with No Name. In spite of my writing and academic record, my classmates probably suspected there was something pathetic about me. I never spoke of my family, neither issued nor accepted any invitations outside school, and always refused to eat the candies and snacks brought by my friends. My hairstyle, shoes, socks, and book bag did not inspire envy. No one from home ever came to be with me on prize-giving day, regardless of how many awards I had won. They didn't know that in front of them I was desperate to keep up the pretense that I came from a normal, loving family. I couldn't possibly tell anyone the truth. How worthless and ugly Nyang made me feel most of the time. How I was held responsible for any misfortune and was resented for simply being around. How my mind was racked with anxiety and constantly burdened by an impending sense of doom. How I simply loathed myself and wished I could disappear, especially when I was in front of my parents. The worst of it was that I could see no way out. That was why I found it hard to fall asleep and sometimes still wet my bed. But if I tried to be really good and studied very, very hard, perhaps things would become different one day, I would think. Meanwhile, I must not tell anyone how bad it really was. I should just go to school every day and carry inside me this dreadful loneliness, a secret I could never share. Otherwise, it would be over, and Father and Nyang would never come to love me. Chapter 10, Shanghai School Days. Of all the girls in my class at Shengshen, Wu Chunmei was the most athletic. She came from one of Shanghai's wealthiest merchant families and lived in an imposing mansion near the French Club, which I passed daily on my way to and from school. Her father had spurned commerce for medicine and attended medical school in the United States, where Chunmei was born. Her mother was a well-known artist and book illustrator. Being an only daughter, Chunmei was privileged in many ways. I first noticed Wu Chunmei when we played shuttlecock against each other one day during recess. A shuttlecock was a rounded piece of cork with feathers stuck on top. When the shuttlecock was hit to and fro with a racket across a net, the game was called badminton. At Shengshen, we sometimes used the shuttlecock to play a different game. We would kick it up and down and add up the number of kicks made without interruption. The girl with the highest number of kicks was the winner. I had always considered myself a skillful player, but my first game against Wu Chunmei turned into an exhibition featuring my opponent's talent. Unlike the rest of us, who counted ourselves pretty lucky if we could kick the shuttlecock 15 times in a row, Wu Chunmei could go on indefinitely. While kicking the shuttlecock frontways, sideways, and behind her, she could also clap her hands, twist her legs, and even turn her body all the way around. In due course, I became more and more impressed by Wu Chunmei's athletic skills. She had strength, agility, coordination, and amazing prowess at all types of physical games, especially ping pong, badminton, and volleyball. Best of all, she possessed a single-minded fierceness, a fearless loyalty toward her teammates. Like me, she also loved to read. Unlike me, she was able to bring to school an incredible variety of children's books, many translated from foreign languages, which she generously lent to everyone. One morning, on her way to school in her father's chauffeur-driven car, she saw me plodding along, carrying my heavy school bag. She asked her driver to stop and offered me a lift. Though sorely tempted, I had no choice but to refuse, saying with a laugh that I enjoyed walking. Chunmei made nothing of it until 2 weeks later. It had been raining very hard, and the streets were flooded. There were typhoon warnings, and school had been let out early. Many of the girls were stranded, waiting to be picked up by their families. Chun-mei had phoned her father, who came at once in his car to fetch her. On their way home, they saw me sloshing through ankle-deep water. Wu Chun-mei stopped the car and rolled down the window. "Who's this lone small figure struggling along deserted Avenue Joffre, braving the elements?" her father asked. "How about a ride?"
No, thank you,"
I began, desperately clutching my school bag with one hand and my umbrella with the other.
"It's fun to walk in a big storm like this."
As I spoke, a gust of wind almost lifted me off the pavement. My umbrella turned inside out, and I was blown sideways against a lamppost. Dr. Wu got out of his car and stood in the pouring rain, looking almost angry.
"Don't you know it's dangerous to walk in weather like this?" he asked.
Then he bundled me into the back seat. I was drenched from head to toe. The water in my shoes made a puddle on the car mat. Rivulets of water dripped from my hair, which was plastered against my head. I had no raincoat. My uniform stuck to me, and I was shivering. I knew I looked awful, but felt I must keep up appearances. So I smiled and spoke of the storm as if it were a great adventure. At the entrance to my lane, I insisted on getting out and walking to my house because I was terrified of getting into trouble for having accepted a lift. I simply could not run the risk of having Niang see me being driven to the front door in a car. They must have thought I was mad when I stepped back into the storm. Wu Chun-mei and I became friends and partnered each other when we played doubles in ping-pong or badminton. She lent me her books, and I helped her with arithmetic. Though Chun-mei excelled in English and spoke it without an accent, she was hopeless at math and often came under the teacher's fire. Though her chauffeured car invariably awaited her when school finished, she often chose to walk with me until we reached her house, with her driver trailing behind at a snail's pace. In the morning, if she happened upon me trudging along, she would order her driver to stop and would hop out and accompany me all the way. In August 1945, when I was almost 8 years old, America dropped the atom bomb on Japan. This ended the Second World War. America was the new conqueror. At school, we were given surplus sea rations for our lunch, left by China's new heroes, the U.S. Marines. We ate hard biscuits, canned meat, and chunks of bittersweet chocolate. After each meal, we prayed and thanked our American allies for winning the war. Hollywood movies swept into Shanghai like a tidal wave. There was a craze for everything American. One day in September 1945, all the children in my school were bused to the Bund to welcome the American soldiers. Along with my schoolmates, I cheered, waved welcoming flags, curtsied, and presented bouquets. American minesweepers, cruisers, and flagships clogged the muddy waters of the Huangpu River. Hotels and office buildings on the Bund were taken over by the U.S. Navy and other American servicemen. Photographs of American movie stars adorned billboards and magazine covers. Clark Gable, Vivian Leigh, Lana Turner, and Errol Flynn became household names. Their popularity soared. One schoolmate 2 years ahead of us in Form 5 actually received an autographed photo from Clark Gable, sent all the way to Shanghai from Hollywood, California. She was surrounded by half the school at recess. We were born on a frenzy of excitement at the sight of the picture of the handsome actor, each of us clamoring to hold him in our hands and gaze into his dreamy eyes, even if just for a few seconds. About then, Wu Chunmei lent me a book titled A Little Princess, translated from English into Chinese. She told me it was one of her favorites and had been written by an English author named Frances Hodgson Burnett. This fairy tale of 7-year-old motherless Sarah Crewe, who started life as an heiress, turned overnight into a penniless servant girl, and eventually changed her life through her own efforts, gripped my imagination as no other book had ever done before. I read it again and again, suffered Sarah's humiliation, cried over her despair, mourned the loss of her father, and savored her final triumph. I kept it so long that Wu Chunmei became impatient and demanded its return. Coming from a secure and happy home, Wu Chunmei could not grasp the impact this message of hope had upon me. For the first time, I realized that adults could be wrong in their judgment of a child. If I tried hard enough to become a princess inside, like Sarah Crewe, perhaps I too might one day reverse everyone's poor opinion of me. Reluctant to relinquish my newfound treasure, I begged to keep it for another 2 weeks. Laboriously and doggedly, I copied the book word for word into 2 exercise books during this grace period, committed parts of it to memory, and slept with it under my pillow until the manuscript became tattered. Though Wu Chunmei and I spent numerous school hours together, not once did I mention my family or hint at the presence of a stepmother. In many ways, I envied my friend. As much as possible, in front of her, I pretended that I had loving parents too.